That was a good start. This podcast of Word of Mouth is supported in part by Doucette Survey.
Nice.
Doucette Survey, serving your professional land surveying mapping needs in New England, now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine.
There's more information at doucetsurvey.com. We could do it like robots.
Word of Mouth Daily Podcast, sponsored by Doucette Survey.
Word of Mouth.
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 Word of
Mouth.
Word of
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Earlier today, nurse Casey Hickox defied Maine state health officials by leaving her home and going for a bicycle ride with her boyfriend. Authorities in Maine are seeking a court order to keep Hickox in her home. She was quarantined last week against her will in New Jersey upon arrival from Sierra Leone, where she'd spent a month treating Ebola patients. Hickox has tested negative for the virus and insists that she is no threat to public health. So far, one person in the U.S. has died of Ebola. Three people who contracted the disease have been released after treatment, and a New York doctor is currently being treated. Given those small numbers, a number of health officials warn that the hysteria over Ebola may be a much more dangerous epidemic, citing, for example, the temporary shutdown of the Pentagon last week when a woman vomited in the parking lot, fear of people from all of the African continent, and other panicked responses. Marty Nemko is a writer, speaker, and host for KALW Public Radio in San Francisco. He wrote an article for Time Magazine's idea section called The Absurd Cost of Overreaction. And Marty Nemko, welcome to Word of Mouth.
My pleasure to be with you.
So we can guess from the title where you stand. What, to your mind, are some of the overreactive responses to the Ebola virus?
Well, almost all of it. There's only been one person who has died in America, and all the experts say that the probability of any kind of massive expansion of the disease in the United States is trivial, and yet we are spending literally billions of dollars on it for everything from screening every healthcare professional to having committee after committee decide how much screening should there be of passengers coming in from where. We don't think probabilistically.
Tell me about what you mean by probabilistically. This is something that also came up in a Psychology Today article you wrote about the response. What does that mean?
We tend to think viscerally. We tend to think, oh my God, it's a horrible disease. It's a very high fatality rate. So we've got to do everything we can to stop it, without asking ourselves, what is the cost benefit and the risk reward? For example, every time we expend a dollar or every time we expend an hour of our time, there is a cost, what we otherwise could be spending the dollar or the hour of time on. And so, for example, we've moved in this country to a major move toward bicycling, and there are tons of deaths and maimings as a result of bicycling, and almost no money is spent on trying to get the public to be more aware of bicyclists as we drive. We could, with far greater certitude, save more lives by focusing on that than the massive response we're having to Ebola. That's more probabilistic thinking. Where is the dollars and where is the time likely to make a bigger difference?
But this is a serious public health issue. I mean, we've watched on the news how it's devastated people in three countries, primarily in West Africa. So people are afraid. How do we get off of the fear, the panic button, and actually look more probabilistically, I'll use your term, at the science?
No. The probability is what it is. Here in America, is the probability high that we in America are going to get more benefit from spending millions and billions of dollars of money and time trying to stem the spread of Ebola here? The fact that it's in Guinea and West Africa has little relationship to that. We tend to viscerally say, oh my God, look what's going on there. And frankly, the media has been truly the perpetrator of this. It has fanned the flames of this rather than themselves thinking probabilistically.
Well, we do know some cases of severe overreaction to students who had moved from Rwanda to Burlington, New Jersey, were kept home from school. Now, Rwanda, no cases at all of Ebola, thousands of miles away. Parents pulled their kids out of a Mississippi school because of a concern that the principal had visited Zambia, 3,000 miles away from the affected West African countries. Now, Marty, you offer examples of how panic has guided U.S. response to previous events or tragedies at great cost. And what are some examples of those?
My favorite example, of course, is the shoe bomber. The shoe bomber put a plastic explosive in and tried to blow up a plane. Every terrorist knows that we now make every single human being take off their shoes. What are the odds that a terrorist was going to choose that as their modus operandi? And yet we continue to lose millions of minutes of passenger time and the indirect cost to society. People just are ever less likely to want to travel because of the ever greater incursions and the greater time it takes, all because of something that has a near zero probability of occurring.
Well, we're looking at the forcible quarantines under New Jersey Governor Chris Christie and New York Governor Andrew Cuomo of people who are returning from West Africa, in the case of Casey Hickox, a nurse who had served in Sierra Leone. But Andrew Cuomo, for his part, said, better safe than sorry. Now, would you want to be the person on whose watch a shoe bomber did decide to slip through and not take his shoes off, and I'm assuming it's a he? Would you want to be the governor of a state who let somebody who was infected with Ebola into the state?
That is really the word, better safe than sorry, is the most anti-intellectual, really, I hate to use the word, but stupid CYA approach to anything. If we are insisting on maximum safety, we should never leave our houses because we might get bitten by a rattlesnake if we leave. It is a CYA strategy.
Well, what does CYA mean, by the way? I don't know.
Cover your ass. Because, you know, no politician wants to appear to have done nothing. And for the one in a 10 million chance that somebody in Arkansas is going to get Ebola, we are willing to reallocate millions and billions of dollars, not billions in the case of Arkansas, but millions of dollars away from something that would more certainly do good, because we're afraid, oh, better safe than sorry. We can't control all risk. We must probabilistically assess where are our dollars and time best spent.
All right, let me get to the money for a second. The WHO has estimated that it will take nearly $1 billion required to fight Ebola globally. So far, the Obama administration has delivered and or committed about $750 million. But even if it doesn't ever reach U.S. shores, is it not worth dedicating that level of resources to help stop the disease in Guinea, in Sierra Leone, in Liberia, the three West African countries where thousands have died?
It's there we get into a gray area. What is the value of a human life? What is the opportunity cost? Right now, we have billions of kids in Africa who are not immunized against diseases we know that are curable. We're not spending the money on that. I'm not again, you know, that's a tough call. I do think the worldwide community, because the African infrastructure, health infrastructure is so paltry and the loss of human life is so great, then yes, can I argue against that? No, now we're in the gray areas, but to spend the hundreds of millions of dollars that we're spending here in this country to stop Ebola in this country, that seems clear.
Marty Nemko, thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Marty Nemko, career coach, writer, speaker, and host of Working with Marty Nemko on KALW Public Radio in San Francisco. We do have a link to read his article in Time magazine called The Absurd Cost of Overreaction. That's at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. And the panic continues. We ponder the question, where would you go if a zombie apocalypse hit New Hampshire? We'll stake out a spot when Word of Mouth continues after a short break. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. For those willing to risk the extreme weather, the summit of Mount Washington has much to offer, aside from the hiking and climbing. Visitors can catch a bite at the Tip Top House. You can tour the Mount Washington Observatory Museum, which is the state's most popular. And if the skies are clear, take in a spectacular view. There's one other possible perk that New England's highest peak is not known for. Producer Taylor Quimby reports.
In 1934, a weather observer stationed at the peak of Mount Washington recorded a then-record wind gust of 231 miles per hour. As a point of reference, that's in the same neighborhood as an F5 tornado. And yet, Mount Washington isn't just home of the world's worst weather, as a sign at the summit famously boasts. It's also home to a concrete weather station where a team of researchers live year-round. And, if you ask me, it's the perfect place to survive the zombie apocalypse.
You know, it's funny you mentioned that, because when I first climbed right up this ridge, that was actually my very first thought when I got inside these walls. I was like, you know what, this would make an excellent zombie holdout.
Yeah. Was it really?
Yeah, I actually thought that. Yeah, it's
first thought.
You know?
It's a perfect fortress up here, you know? You got the one road coming up, snipe the zombies if they're coming.
Yeah.
You get your supplies by the train here, protect it very easily, you know, sit on top. I don't know, like a video game.
What's your name?
Paul Molesky, Brother Paul Molesky.
There's nothing fun about imagining life, say, after a nuclear war, or fantasizing about how you'd survive a global pandemic. But there is something oddly intriguing about a zombie apocalypse.
You can talk about things like bottled water and stockpiling antibiotics and, oh, we need a radio. And if you know deep down in your heart that it's because of zombies, then you can still sleep at night.
It's fake, so it's safe. That's Max Brooks, by the way, author of World War Z and The Zombie Survival Guide. Now, I don't own a gas mask or keep a stockpile of canned tuna in my basement. In other words, I'm no prepper. But I really do enjoy a good zombie escape plan. Because you don't have to be an Olympic athlete or a trained Navy SEAL to survive a zombie apocalypse. Anybody with a good head on their shoulders has a fighting chance. It's all about good planning and making do with limited resources. But after visiting Mount Washington for the first time last September, I just couldn't stop thinking about it. I pictured striking out after the first zombies hit southern New Hampshire, guiding my family from our home in Concord towards my mom's place in North Conway. I'd be wearing somebody's discarded plaid jacket, sporting a rugged post-apocalyptic beard, and wielding a modified shovel as a combination walking stick and zombie basher. I pictured us arriving at the top, cold and weary, but safe. The closest thing to a happily ever after, given the circumstances, surviving indefinitely in our little castle, the Mount Washington Observatory. But how realistic is this fantasy? Aside from the living dead part, I mean, the general idea being that the mountain and the extreme weather would act as a natural defense against the zombies, it's everything else I wonder about, the survival part. So before I went back up the mountain to do an inventory, I called Max Brooks and asked him what to look for in a good zombie fort.
A source of water, that's the most important. If you don't have a source of water, you're dead in 3 days. Does it have the ability to dispose of your excrement? Because if you let that stuff pile up, you'll be just dead from disease. Is it far enough away from any thoroughfares? Because what you don't want is people deserting their cars on the freeway and blundering into your fort, or seeing it from the air and saying, oh, remember that observatory that we flew over on the mountaintop? Yeah, once we crash the plane in the lake, let's double back and find that.
Okay, let's start with water. Ryan Knapp, night meteorologist at the Mount Washington Observatory.
Yep, we have a well that goes several hundred feet down, about 600 to 800, I've heard from others. Fresh water gets pulled up from the Lake of the Clouds aquifer.
Water? Check. Now, I know what you're thinking. What if the station loses power? Won't the pump stop working? Back before a main line was installed, the station used to run on kerosene generators, and they're still there as a backup. Knapp says the enormous tanks that sit on a ridge just below the observatory still hold enough fuel to power the station for up to a year. Okay, next question. Where does the waste go? Bill Grenfell, director of museum operations.
Well, the summit is self-contained. All the waste, it flows downhill into a treatment plant that uses biological means to break down everything and filter it.
Waste? Check. Next question? Sleeping arrangements. A floor down from the research portion of the building are the living quarters, a comfortable set of rooms with a distinct college dorm feel, except for the bedrooms.
It's triple bunk beds, side by side, and they're pretty comfy.
That's Caitlin O'Brien, an education specialist at the observatory, or the OBS, as they call it. The OBS has 17 beds in total, plus a couple of couches. So plenty of room for me, my son, and my wife. But not my extended family. Next up, food.
That one on the left there has all of our frozen fruits and vegetables and things like that.
The pantry is stocked with giant cans of beans, huge slabs of frozen meat, jumbo boxes of cereal, you name it. Bulk food gets delivered every 2 months, and Caitlin guesses the staff could probably survive for about three once the delivery stopped coming. Scott Henley, the observatory's executive director.
We have the communications infrastructure. We have the facility. We have the food. We don't have much in the way of artillery, except for some shovels.
Crowbars.
Crowbars, yeah, we do have plenty of crowbars.
Those are actually good zombie weapons.
Oh, see? We're more prepared than we thought.
All in all, it's as comfortable a home as anybody could hope for at 6,228 feet above sea level. There's just one really big problem. Max Brooks.
Well, I think simply by doing this story, you've invalidated it.
Uh-oh.
Yeah, yeah, because the most important aspect of a zombie fortress is anonymity. See, the biggest problem in a zombie outbreak is not going to be zombies. It's going to be refugees. Because zombies are not a tenth as dangerous as a desperate Homo sapien.
Right.
And so you're going to be dealing with a lot of hungry, sick, scared, very desperate people who have heard this report and now know exactly how attractive the Mount Washington Observatory is.
The observatory is just too conspicuous. I mean, how many bumper stickers have you seen that say, "This car climbed Mount Washington"? More people visit the Observatory Museum than they do any other museum in New Hampshire, and it's only open 5 months out of the year. Not even the staff is totally convinced of the zombie plan. Here's Serena Bride, director of summit operations at the OBS.
If it were just me, I'd say yeah, but the more people I have with me, or the larger the group, or more people that I have to care for or support, the more that I'm going to question if it's the right move or not, just because it's such a difficult and treacherous environment.
When Max Brooks wrote World War Z, he accomplished a very, very improbable task. He managed to write a serious, literary zombie novel, one that transcends the silliness of the genre. And as I talked to people for this story, I learned to appreciate just how difficult that really is. Because to take something like zombies seriously, you have to become a legitimate authority on a make-believe subject. You have to be able to answer questions like these.
Well, I was just wondering how their coordination is with coming up over the rocks. I mean, especially if it's like a windy day, for example, how they'd be doing.
Are zombies susceptible to hypothermia?
That's a good question. What do you think?
I don't know. I would hope so.
Yeah. Do zombies have four-wheel drive? Because then that would make a difference.
Good, yeah.
As I fielded each one of these questions with a straight face and not a hint of irony, I started to wonder about the sanity of this project. I caught myself in the shower, daydreaming about the logistics of burying supplies on the Appalachian Trail. At work, I silently evaluated the worth of my colleagues. And at some point, I had to ask myself, am I becoming a prepper? Max Brooks.
I actually think a little bit of prepping is a very healthy thing. In fact, the federal government supports that. You know, organizations like FEMA and the CDC, they want you to prep. They want you to be ready for at least a couple weeks because, God forbid, there is a mega disaster. There simply isn't enough federal and state resources to help everybody on day one. But I think where it gets dangerous is this notion of people who are excited about society as a whole collapsing. You know, the people that you see on doomsday preppers, those are the carnival freaks. They want society to implode. And those people I would encourage to get a one-way ticket to Somalia and go live the dream.
It's not that I want society to implode, as Max puts it. But when survival is reduced to having a job and paying rent, going to the grocery store, when the stakes are in some way just as high, but the adrenaline is utterly low, the zombie apocalypse can sound downright thrilling. It has nothing to do with the living dead, really. It has everything to do with living life.
Let me ask you an odd question.
Yeah.
If there were like a zombie apocalypse, what do you think about hiding out on the top of Mount Washington?
hell, I'd be there in a heartbeat, hole into some cave, right? Send them in, we'll put the boulders to them.
So you think it'd be a good spot?
Oh, yeah, I think you could hide out, but you probably wouldn't want that getting out. Next thing you know, the militia will be up here wanting to hide out in the mountains, right?
I think that's the worst part. Exactly. If we came up with a good idea...
As for whether Mount Washington would be a good place to ride out the zombie apocalypse, I think it's pretty clear that the real answer is no. Because as soon as we all agree it's a good idea, it becomes a really, really bad one. My hope is that in doing this investigation, I'll have convinced everybody to rule it out, and then at least the staffers, who are already up there, might have a passing chance at making it work, should the zombie apocalypse go down. As for me, I'm going to try and spend less time thinking about zombies and more time prepping for the occasional power outage or ice storm. Refresh my stock of candles and flashlights, pick up some batteries, maybe buy a few gallons of bottled water. Because how sad would it be to be ready for zombies, but get caught unprepared for another New England winter? For Word of Mouth, I'm Taylor Quimby.
Well, Taylor may have blown Mount Washington's cover, but there are plenty of places in New Hampshire where you could hunker down for a zombie apocalypse. Where in the state would you head if the zombies were on the march? Remember, you'd have to have a fresh water supply, and it would have to be zombie-proof. Let us know on our Facebook page, facebook.com/wordofmouthradio. And stay with us as we move from zombies to, well, zombies and monsters and alligator people. The best B-movies Halloween has to offer. That's when Word of Mouth returns after the break. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. When it comes to American holidays, Christmas and Thanksgiving are the favorites. That's at least according to a Harris Interactive poll. For comedian Dana Gould, it's all about Halloween. Throughout his career in comedy, Dana Gould has performed on The Late Show with David Letterman, on Conan, The Ben Stiller Show, as well as in his own stand-up specials for HBO. But his love of Halloween and the B-horror movies that come with it is perhaps most evident in the 7 years he spent writing and producing The Simpsons. Among the episodes he worked on, Treehouse of Horror 17, for which he is credited as co-executive producer Dana Gould. You know, with an H, get it? Dana Gould is the host of the podcast The Dana Gould Hour. So pleased to welcome you to Word of Mouth.
Hi, how are you today?
Very well, and ready to be creeped out if you don't mind.
Indeed. Let's lay down our Halloween rules right out of the gate.
Okay.
I need you to wear something reflective, go with a friend, and don't go into anyone's house if you don't know them.
And don't accept handmade goods or apples.
Yeah. Don't accept any apple with a razor blade handle sticking out of it.
Well, in addition to your rules, you've come prepared to it with a long list of must-see Halloween B-movies. Which has gotten the most play, do you think, in the Gould household?
Well, I like to reference movies that you... I mean, we all know the big movie, Night of the Living Dead, you know, Frankenstein Meets the Wolfman,
right,
which is a particular favorite of mine because of the title. I like that it's not Frankenstein versus the Wolfman.
Oh, they just
that they had this attitude, let's have them meet and see what happens. Let's just let them meet. But there are some movies that are great that you may not know about. Probably number one on the list with a bullet, Carnival of Souls from 1962, made by a guy named Herc Harvey, who basically made industrial films. And it sort of anticipated Night of the Living Dead before Night of the Living Dead. It's quite a brilliant little movie, very, very creepy, about a young woman who escapes death in a car accident, or did she?
Anybody we'd recognize in the movie, or is it...
Nobody. It stars screen legend Candace Hillegas.
Oh, of course.
Yeah, and Herc Harvey himself. But you'll see the story if you know, the film's final destination that were big past decade or so. They're all, each one is in and of itself a remake of Carnival of Souls. It's about somebody who escapes death and death not letting go so easily. It's really a brilliant little movie. For a fun, great B-movie, I recommend The Alligator People.
Oh, I know that one.
The Alligator People is fantastic. It's a black and white film, beautifully shot, really looks like what you think about in terms of a late 50s, late 60s B-horror film. It stars Lon Chaney Jr. And in the film, he has one of my favorite lines in all of history. There's, you know, classic lines. Play it again, Sam. Here's looking at you, kid.
Mm-hmm.
The alligator people adds to that lexicon with, I will always hate gators.
Dirty, stinking, slimy gators. You bit my hand off, didn't you? I'm going to spend the rest of my life killing gators. The rest of my life. Cure.
So you're talking about movies from the 60s, but some of the films on your list go back to the late 40s, 50s, long before your time.
Yeah, the house on... Oh, yeah, long before my time. I was... I grew up in Massachusetts, dutifully watching Creature Double Feature.
Creature Double
every
Feature
Saturday
on TV 56.
Channel 56 with Dale Dorman. And so, yeah, my film education actually predates my existence. A great B-movie from that era, late 50s, The House on Haunted Hill, made by the great William Castle, who is sort of the working class version of Alfred Hitchcock. Vincent Price in fine form. And shot at the Frank Lloyd Wright House in Los Feliz, California.
Well, let's hear just a little bit from that film.
I'm Frederick Lauren, and I've rented the house on Haunted Hill tonight so that my wife can give a party. A haunted house party. She's so amusing. There'll be food and drink and ghosts, and perhaps even a few murders. You're all invited.
Of course, that's Vincent Price. Like, basically, he pays people $10,000 if they can last a whole night on Haunted Hill.
Now, when the house is on Haunted Hill, you pretty much assume you know what's going on. I've rented the house on Haunted Hill to throw a Tupperware party to keep your food fresh over long periods.
Now, that is
it's
creepy.
It's on Haunted Hill, for God's sakes. And you get a, yeah, that's a beautiful, and the real star of that movie, aside from Vincent Price, who gives an amazing Vincent Price caliber performance, is the actual house itself, which is, as I said, a Frank Lloyd Wright house, which is also in the end of the film Blade Runner. It's the same building.
You wouldn't think that a Frank Lloyd Wright house would be the haunted house. You'd think of the, you know, Victorian with the mansard roof.
Yeah, that was the brilliance of William Castle. He did a little, he flipped it. And it works great. It's and that house is still there, which is weird because in the city of Los Angeles, there are now four buildings over 20 years old.
And that's
that is
one of them.
Of the four, and we're very proud. You know, I have children, so you have to be careful about what movies you throw on for Halloween. Surprisingly, a huge hit with my kids, and my kids are savvy modern kids with no attention spans. Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein from 1948.
Okay.
They love it.
We've got a clip from that. Let's hear it.
Where is it?
I saw a hand there.
You don't know what you're talking about. You're all excited reading this legend. Now, listen. Listen, Wilbur. I know there's no such a person as Dracula. You know there's no such a person as Dracula.
But does Dracula know it?
Now, listen to me. McDougal will be here any minute with the insurance agent. Now, get to work.
Beautiful. Now, what's interesting about that film, two things. Bela Lugosi, who, you know, people associate with the role of Dracula, plays Dracula in the movie, was not Universal Studios' first choice to play him. I think the director had to say, what about Bela Lugosi? And they were going, yeah, I don't know.
But this was actually the first of many that they started introducing Abbott and Costello to.
They ended up meeting everybody.
Count Dracula, Frankenstein, the Wolfman.
Yeah, they met Frankenstein, they met Wolf. Yeah, then they met Abbott and Costello meet the Mummy, Abbott and Costello meet the Invisible Man, they met Fluoridation. They met all the threats of the day.
So that's a kind of family-friendly horror comedy. Any truly terrifying B-movie horror films, you know, where you... That transparent line just comes down.
Oh, sure. Oddly, the 1970s was a great decade for really scary films. One film from that decade that does not get its credit is a film called Let's Scare Jessica to Death. Early 70s movie, low budget, incredibly creepy, hampered only by... It must have been from like 71 or 72 when people really... needed cream rinse and haircuts. It is only hampered by that. There are some mustaches in that movie that would not make it onto the screen today, but highly recommended. And then two TV movies that I recall from the early 70s that were really scary. One of them, When Michael Calls.
Oh, right. Okay.
1972.
All right. We have a little clip of that. Let's hear it.
Hello? Hello?
Andy, my Helen.
Yes, hello?
Andy, my Helen. I missed the school bus. Come and get me.
Who is this?
It's Michael.
What? Hello? Hello?
Elizabeth Ashley playing the aunt of a boy who died, what, 14 years earlier or something like
yes.
that?
Yes.
When you grew up, there were movies like The Texas Chainsaw Massacre, Halloween, The Omen, you know, The Exorcist out in
right.
theaters. Those were sort of the more realistic ones. You didn't think that the B movies that you were watching were hokey?
I did, but I love them for the hokiness. I love the fact that they tried. You know, Plan 9 from Outer Space is one of my favorite movies of all time, because I feel like if I got to make a movie, it'd probably come out like that.
We're talking to the comedian and host of the Dana Gould Hour podcast, Dana Gould, about the wicked scariest movies he grew up watching. Well, how important is it to know the backstory of the movies to you? You mentioned directors and you mentioned switches and
none
actors.
At all. I enjoy it because it's my football. You know, it's my I don't have a fantasy football team, but I can tell you who directed The Night Stalker. It's just my area of interest. It's what I grew up loving. But you don't need to. But I kind of love the fact that, like in Plan 9 from Outer Space, you can see that the graveyard is a set. You can see the when somebody falls down, you can see the cardboard graves sort of shaking. I don't know why, but it appeals to me. We have an expression in show business called hair in the gate, which is when you'd have to check after you shot a scene, you'd have to check the camera to make sure that there wasn't a hair in the lens, because mm-hmm. that would show up in the film. Sometimes I like it when there's a hair in the gate. It gives it a little sense of flaw.
And you've taken this love of these horror movies into the real world, befriending, is it Myla Nurmi? Is that how you pronounce her name?
Yes. Myla Nurmi was in the film Plan 9 from Outer Space. She was the very first person to host horror movies. Her alter ego was Vampyra. She first premiered in Los Angeles on local television in 1954 and created this character, sort of a sexier version of Morticia Adams. And before Morticia Adams was on television, by the way, by 6 or 7 years. And she was really, she started that whole sort of genre of entertainment that later begat Goulardi and Zachary and Creature Double Feature. Mm-hmm. And I interviewed her in 1995 for a little documentary I was making on horror movie hosts, because I'm so obsessed with them. And we became good friends, and we stayed very close friends for the rest of her life.
Yeah, she died, what, 2008?
She passed on in 2008, but that didn't stop me from putting her on my new podcast.
That's a really good Halloween trick, raising the dead for an interview.
Tis. I dug up an old interview. Get it?
So why is it important to keep the legacy alive of these people who were, you know, not even the actors in some cases, but the hosts, the presenters of Creature Double Features and scary movies?
The lower down the show business ladder you get, the more comfortable I feel. You know, in the evolutionary map of show business, where movie stars and opera divas are at the far end, I'm much more comfortable way down here helping the rodeo clown get into the barrel.
You're sort of this little fish crawling out of the water part of evolution.
That's my comfort zone. I would much rather go to a carnival than the symphony. And it's just the stuff I love.
Well, thanks for putting a little hair on our lens or microphone or whatever metaphor I can mix up for this one.
Yeah, hair in the windscreen.
Really appreciate your time.
Oh, my God. I had such a great time. Thank you so very much.
Dana Gould, actor, producer, comedian, and host of the podcast The Dana Gould Hour. We've compiled a list of his must-see B-horror movies on our website, wordofmouthradio.org. Up next, the pained ghost of an 18th century hunter shrieks in agony when darkness falls. A Native American warrior's spirit recounts the massacre of his tribe. And a haunted pond has tales to tell. We're going to take a tour of Hillsborough County's spooky history when Word of Mouth continues. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. New England is full of stories. Every old road, stone wall, and forgotten cellar hole has an origin tale. And with the rattling leaves and crisp black nights of fall upon us, we are on the hunt for the spookiest Halloween-y stories. The historian Eric Stanway has found plenty of them. His new book, Haunted Hillsborough County, digs beyond the official history of land where Native Americans roamed, Puritans settled, and generations of flinty New Englanders carried their legends and spirits from the old country as they eked out families, farms, and factories in the new world. We looked through the many houses and inns and barns and town halls and cemeteries in Eric's book and settled on visiting Haunted Pond in Francistown. Word of Mouth senior producer Maureen McMurray and I met Eric Stanway on the town green, just as the bells of the white clapboard community church pealed noon. We then followed him to a small beach at Haunted Pond, a lovely, shallow pond rimmed with summer cottages, birches, and pines. Really the picture of serenity, despite the number of people who met their ends there. I asked Eric where the name Haunted Pond came from.
The story goes that back in 1741, two guys came down here from Hillsborough, and they were looking to buy land down here. And apparently they came down here totally independently of each other. And they camped on the side of the pond, and they had an argument about something, and one of them ended up bashing the other one over the head with something heavy, buried him in a shallow grave. And then the story was that the other fellow was screaming and crying, walking through the woods for years and years after that. And there was a minister from Bedford who came in here in the 1750s, and he wanted to survey it. He brought in a chain gang. Well, they were obliged to spend the night here on the shore. And over the course of the night, they heard all sorts of horrible screaming and howling going on. And all of the chain men the next morning said, well, that's it, mate, you're on your own. And, and they all backed out of here.
A little clarification here. The official name of Haunted Pond is Scobie Pond for David Scobie, an immigrant from Belfast, Ireland. He came to the region to set up a mill near the pond in 1780. While digging the foundation for the mill, workers discovered the skeleton of a young man buried in a shallow grave, further cementing the pond's deadly reputation in the minds of locals, something Scobie's rambunctious sons exploited.
His sons, who were teenagers at the time, they got really bored around here. And the idea was that the place had developed such a reputation that quote-unquote liquor-laden loafers would show up here hunting for ghosts. And the Scobie brothers decided they weren't going to disappoint them. So what they did was they took a bunch of wood from the sawmill and they nailed pieces of cloth to it. And then they would douse it with kerosene and set them off across the water out here so that these people would see these moving lights going across the pond. Just to put some icing on the cake, they decided they'd hide behind their tents and scream and howl and whip chains around and things like that. And this went on for a good long while until the cops got wind of it and they basically told them to knock it all off, to which point they went back to being really bored again.
Life is much more exciting in a small town with ghosts.
Oh, yeah. We need to do something out here.
But, Eric, that leads to something. The question of these legends get formed, they get fed and reinforced over the years, sometimes by antics like that. But how do you trace a legend? How do you know what's real?
Well, an awful lot of it you just have to take on trust. Lots of the material that I got comes from the history of Francistown. And he talks extensively about these things that happened around here. But people don't like to talk about Haunted Pond here. You know, I mean, I was in the surveyor's office and I saw it's on a map, and I said, Haunted Palm, what's that all about? And the secretary says, you don't want to know about that.
Should we try to find the mill?
Or yeah. Is that too ambitious of us?
No, it's, where did he say it was?
And so we set off to find David Scobie's mill, which Eric thought he remembered being close by.
This is looking familiar to me.
We walked along a dirt road and then a path through the woods that were once the stomping grounds of Passaconaway, chief of the Penacook tribe, whose land was overtaken and were sold off to pay debts to the colonials. Oh, we've got something here.
This is the Scobie Mill. Oh, what's left of it.
Though no skeletons, no evidence of lingering spirits. Unremarkable if you didn't know of the human remains left clumsily behind hundreds of years before.
I would say it was somewhere down in the middle here, because they said it was when they were digging the original parts of the foundation out. So the skeleton would have been found right around here. Creepy stuff, isn't it?
I don't know. I was thinking it looks kind of benign and sweet. A person who would consider yourself a ghost hunter? Do you use machines to read heat or light or anything like that?
Oh, goodness, no. I'm a historian.
Well, that's what I was wondering about. I mean, you were a reporter for a long time. So when you're reporting on these kind of legends, which hat are you wearing? The skeptic hat or the believer hat?
I believe in it, but I don't actually go around and hunt them out. What I do is I just get the legends and I gather them together. Then I let the people sort it out themselves. They can make up their own minds about what it is.
Well, you're talking about the history, and that was one of the questions I had for you is about, I don't know, there's the thinking about the karma of a place, if I can use that word, that, you know, the sins that were committed in a place determining its outcome, which is a superstitious kind of point of view. But do you think anything happened in the formation of this land early on or the settlement that could have cast that kind of shadow?
Well, over in Wilton, there's a story of a massacre that took place in 1748, I think, when some of the local Indians from the Sauhegan and Pawtucket tribes, they were going to marry into a tribe from Canada. So they brought all of these Indians in from Canada, and they were going to have a big party, and they were all set to stay there the entire winter. And the locals brought them some gifts, like, here's some stuff, clear off. It didn't work out that way. So basically, they brought in the garrison, and the garrison murdered every man, woman, and child in the place. Ever since then, Wilton's been a hot spot for very, very nasty psychic phenomena.
But here's the rub. The source for that Indian massacre story is the spirit of a Native American warrior named Sochim, which was said to have been channeled by a local group of ghost hunters. So there are some gray areas when looking at history through a ghostly lens. But here's what we do know. History is a record of death, and death was a much more regular part of life in New Hampshire in its colonial and industrial eras. Perhaps the veil between the world of the living and the supernatural appeared thinner then. And that porous veil is what interests Eric Stanway.
I think most of my work is digging up old stories that people don't know and have forgotten about. Sometimes they have ghosts in them, sometimes they don't. But what they all have in common is they're not stories that you'll find anywhere, you know? And they're always creepy.
Eric, if we had said, well, we'd like to meet you at 11 o'clock at night rather than 11 o'clock in the morning here in Francistown, would you have come?
Sure. I'm not scared of ghosts.
Eric Stanway, a kind of local legend here in New Hampshire. He's written 16 books on New England history, as well as a number of graphic novels based on the works of Charles Dickens. He's also been a journalist and editor at newspapers in Massachusetts and New Hampshire. There's more on his book, Haunted Hillsborough County, and other books, as well as some pictures from our visit to Haunted Pond. That's all at wordofmouthradio.org. Thanks so much for joining us today. If you like what you heard, there is plenty more at wordofmouthradio.org. And we would love to hear from you. Are there creepy spots in your town? What are the ghost stories where you live? We just visited Francistown, but surely spooky stories abound in New Hampshire. You can share them on our Facebook page, facebook.com/wordofmouthradio. We all learned as kids, didn't we, that the scariest ghost stories travel by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. Please join us for more Word of Mouth Sunday at noon, right here on New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by
Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
and senior producer Maureen McMurray.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its Board of Trustees,
or its underwriters. Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.